in standard time, but in the land before time. So, like the story of Cinderella or the Ugly Duckling, it's a timeless story because it's a story about the heart, its fears and its hopes, its struggle for faith, and its need. Some of them over these last few weeks, the story of a garden made just for two, the story of a skyscraper taller than City Hall, and today, the final in this short series, the story of the Great Flood. At first, these stories were told by professional storytellers around the various watering holes as the Bedouin tribes moved from place to place with their flocks. And the stories were passed from generation to generation. Indeed, much of the rest of the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, had already been written down before anyone thought of writing down these stories, because stories are to be told rather than to be written. But when they were written down, because they talk about beginnings, the editor said he put them at the beginning of the scriptures. And so the first 11 chapters of Genesis are beginning stories. They are prologue. They set the scene. They pose the earliest questions of science and the deep questions of religion. For example, the early questions of science. What is a rainbow? Why are snakes sneaky? And why do those French have a different word for everything? And more importantly, the questions of religion. Why are there natural disasters? Can we trust a God who must often be angry with us? Is our frail bark at the mercy of the surging waves which sooner or later threaten to engulf us all? The stories are not to be taken literally, of course. Mount Ararat is not remotely the highest mountain in the world. The length of the ark is only about 1.5 times the length of the sanctuary. It's about the length two jumbo jets. Two dinosaurs would fill it. And then you'd have the elephants and the rhinos and all the rest of them. It's not that kind of story. It's a picture story. In other words, it's a parable about all of us grappling with circumstances which we cannot control and struggling to survive in the storms of life. In those first 11 chapters, which were later, there are two themes that keep coming together. The first is the onward march of progress. If you read the story, you'll learn that humankind learned to smelt iron, to build cities, to domesticate animals, to make music. Civilization is on its way. But the other theme that keeps coming in is that as humankind makes progress, the scale of his wickedness seems to increase. Once I learn to make a rope, I can hang a man. If I can learn to make Cyclone B, I can kill 6 million people. So the first chapters in Genesis are not just about progress, they're about the things that keep going wrong. There is this It's not geography. It's Greece. So speak to me not of fear born of natural disasters, but speak to me of faith born of divine fidelity. Speak to me not of man's foresight, but speak to me of God's faithfulness. For if the first part of the story is about the terrible things that are happening on earth, the second part tells me that something is appearing in the heavens. If the first part is about judgment, the second part is about mercy. I will set my bow in the clouds as a sign of an everlasting covenant. Noah will never forget the terrors that came in the night. None of us can. Childhood's fears stay with us all our lives. They come in our nightmares and they disturb our sleep. What if the storm should sweep in again? What if cancer should invade my body or blindness come to my eyes? What if the one who was my north, my south, my east, my west should be taken away? I am left alone with none to talk to and none who understands. The Bible does not believe in the genial optimism that if you're just good, things will be fine. That if God is on our side, things will never go wrong again. For often on Ararat there will be the bubonic plague when 75 million people will cough their way into eternity. After the Battle of the Somme, there will be a flu epidemic which will lay waste more than died in the previous 4 years of a world war. Noah's new world is not paradise regained. It's not Eden back again. It's a world of Midianite raiders, of bricks without straw, of exile from Jerusalem, of blunt nails driven into screaming flesh and darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. So the answer of the Bible to our fears about the future is not touching wood. It's not the genial proposition that if only everybody were all born again, the life of evil would be overcome. It isn't the supposition that if you have enough love, that will be okay, because in the Bible, the main emphasis is not on love, it's actually on justice. Rather, it's the faith that we have a God who writes across the sky, never again in technicolor, for all the world to see, a God who keeps Noah in the flood as he kept Jesus in the flood tide, and will keep us when the storm clouds come. The very first verse that Austin read from, the first verse that Brian read from the Old Testament was in chapter 8. And these are the words I want you to take with you. Three words. God remembered Noah. That is what faith is about. That God remembers us when all the flood is around. that's where we usually leave the story, but there's another piece that's still there. We don't often read it. The old story